Please go ahead. The recordings have started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On today's IRD call on Monday the 12th of July, we have Jeremy Hitchcock, Rafik Damak, Robert Hutchinson, Avery Doria, Yan Kang Yao. From staff, we have Glenda Saint-Géry, Steve Sheng, Dave Piscatello, myself, Gisela Gruber-White, and we have apologies from James Galvin, Steve Metallitz, Ram Mohan. If I could please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Steve.
Thank you, Gisela. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's IRD call. Julie has a doctor appointment, so she asked me to facilitate the call. Jeremy, since you are the co-chair, would you be able to lead this call?
Sure.
Yeah. If I may suggest, Julie send out a draft agenda that has essentially four items. The first point is discussion points from Brussels meeting presentation. She also attached the slides. Second point is issues remaining to be addressed. The third point is the next steps in preparing recommendations and like an interim report. And the last one, she also wants to discuss about the meeting schedule, whether we still want to rotate biweekly to tailor different time zones. So those are the four items on the draft report. Feel free to use any of those, Jeremy, or if you have other items.
This is Jeremy. I don't think so. I think that'll be a good agenda. So we're still a light on attendance, but I guess we'll dive in and start with discussion points from two on the call attended the either session for the IRD update. And anyone?
Sorry, I couldn't. I had opposing or competing meetings.
Okay. So just for the, this is Jeremy again, this, for the update for the group, just to bring everyone up to speed, there were two presentations that were given that brought the community up to speed on where we are. One of them was a quick 10-15 minute update to the GNSO on Monday, and then there was an actual time slot on Thursday morning, kind of as a working session that was specifically for the update on the, and also was intended for community invite and input on where we are. Both presentations had, as was well received, the commentary came across well in terms of the technical detail and the technical background that was on it. So I think we did a good job in getting it so that our slides were well understood. I'll see if I can bucket up the advice or commentary that happened in both events. So for the GSO update, there was a question what PDP work would come out as a result of this, and kind of gave a generic answer saying, well, we're really just looking at kind of the high level information fact finding type of activity, so we're not really specific to anything. And I think that they were potentially alluding to the what requirements might come out of in terms of new GTLDs or in terms of existing PLDs. And then in the working session on Thursday, there was some commentary about variance, which was somewhat interesting in the sense of some items that probably we should bring up for discussion. But aside from that, there wasn't a heck of a lot in terms of commentary saying, hey, this approach is better, or requirements in the sense of we have to have this requirement, we have to have this requirement. So I think that that's also a good sign in the sense of we're just kind of presenting the facts and presenting what the lay of the land is. So in the sense of what the presentation, and where we go from here. We talked about a November timeline for having a report that's completed, including some recommendations and going through the last items that we have in our working group to facilitate, which is to go through the different alternatives and come up with some impacts. There's also a few lingering issues on how we would present some data, some content. But aside from that, I think that's essentially where we are. I think we've done a lot of the groundwork, and from here it's starting to coalesce the information that we have into a workable set of recommendations and report. I'm assuming that the November timeline will actually work out pretty well. It's still a good number of months to go, but also can't dawdle. So over the summer, we'll have to keep up and keep going. The only other thing that was worth mentioning was that the for those people who are in Brussels, the law enforcement community had a stronger presence. We were doing kind of a dog and pony show, going around and talking about the recommendations that they made in Seoul and went around to a lot of the different community groups and talked about their concerns and nationalized who is something that they're interested in because it's from the law enforcement community as a topic. Something that they know is a problem, but they really don't know too much about it. We've been one of the head or the point person for the law enforcement community, and I traded a couple of emails about what was going on. But I think aside from that, I think it was a good update, and there wasn't too much that came out of it in the sense of we're doing everything wrong and we're going in the wrong direction. So I think that's a great set of a great outcome. So from here, issues that are remaining. Did I highlight that as kind of a? Let's just go around just because there's a smaller group. Is that sound like all the issues that need to get addressed and a working forward plan?
Thank you, Jeremy. What do others call on the call think? You have something to add? No? That doesn't seem to be.
I guess that's a good approach working forward.
Yeah, this is Bob Hutchinson. I would add a couple of observations from things I saw at Brussels. There was also a paper that was released on who is performance, which might be of interest to people on this call. It was done by a group back east. I probably can dig up the reference to it. It was a fascinating paper from the standpoint of attempting to validate the Whois system from the standpoint of how often Whois servers are alive and how often they're failing. And basically they built some scripts to ping Whois servers. It showed with some pretty graphic data the unreliability of the current Whois system in terms of the server network associated with it itself. So that was kind of interesting. And the other piece of data that I think is sort of relevant, and it has to do with the servicing of privacy reveal requests. I was in the registrar's meeting, and there was quite a heated discussion about enforcement by David Giza memo that went out essentially that said that within 5 days might be relevant, not so much for the data part that we're concentrating on, but for the mechanics part that Dave is going to tell us. And maybe Dave can comment about that.
Hi, this is Dave. Are you talking about the NewJohn report?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. So that answers one of the two questions. And then when you say mechanics, can you just be a little bit more specific? Are you talking about I'm certain, I'm not quite certain what you mean by mechanics. So I just want to understand how to answer the question.
This is can I add something before we ask Dave to go too far? I think that a lot of people have gotten really interested in the content of NewJohn, but I do think that we need to be really careful what degree of truth and scientific validity we attach to it. And sure, while if 10 to 20% of it is indeed scientifically sustainable, we do have some concerns, but A, I'm not sure how pertinent they are for a group that's trying to figure out how to store and save information, and B, I just would not want to quickly start taking actions that presume that it is a as I say, scientifically valid study. Thanks.
And what makes you believe that it's not a scientifically valid study?
Basically, the methodology. This is Aubrey again. The methodology explained. It's very hand wavy. It's very subjective. As I say, I don't and I don't think this is necessarily the working group for discussing that validity. And you know, if there's content in it that pertains to IDN representation of data and storage of data, that may be worth talking about. But basically to take any presumption from that report and to call it valid is just way premature in my opinion and not necessarily applicable to this effort. Thanks.
So this is Dave. So let me answer or at least speak to Aubrey's point. My understanding is that the compliance department is going to review exactly the methodology and exactly the result or thoroughly the results that the NewJohn people posted. And there are Aubrey is expressing I think a concern that was expressed by a number of people, and not simply registrars who were unhappy that it wasn't clear. Wasn't clear from the report exactly how they established availability and lack of availability, and it's also it's also known in the community that a lot of the methodologies are not that are used to determine who is uptime have some degree of error. So I think it's worthwhile letting compliance use what the NewJohn people published as sort of a notice that perhaps there's more to be done in the from compliance's perspective in understanding not only how accurate those results are, but what would be a better methodology and a reliable methodology to produce and reproduce statistics that demonstrate either compliance or non-compliance. That sort of information is probably going to be extremely helpful in understanding how to to build enforcement mechanisms for the 2009 RAA as an example. So I think that that understanding repeated offenders, if there are such things as repeated offenders in this context, is probably valuable. But I also agree with Aubrey that it's only tangentially an issue for what we're trying to accomplish here. So I think we've answered the first question I asked Rod. I'm happy to answer the second question, but again, I'm just trying to understand which aspect of the mechanisms you are looking to me for an answer for.
Well, I was just saying that the new RAA requirement to reveal privacy is not enforced or tracked in who is at all today, but in a future system it may be one of the requirements of what you're doing. In other words, your presentation, Dave, I don't believe covers that.
Oh, you mean on the privacy protection, the abuse of privacy protection services?
Yes.
I think, you know, so maybe we can wrap this up fairly quickly. The abuse studies that we've been doing, are trying to answer some specific questions about, you know, how prevalent abuse is in, and you know, who is doing it, and are there any noteworthy flocking points in, you know, among the privacy protection providers. Steve and I are going to continue to do that, and hopefully we'll have more data shortly, because we're going to run another batch and study again. But I think generally what we need to do in order to have better measurements is to have better tools. And there's considerable discussion at ICANN on how to get those, and Steve and I have certainly talked about what they might look like and how we might put them together with some of the some of the IT folks and some of the compliance folks. So yes, we do need better mechanisms to actually say, there's two questions we need to answer at this point, I think. One is, how do we know is there a metric, that we can measure that will allow us to say whether or not a legitimate privacy protection service provider, someone who's operating the business, either as a registrar or as a contractor to a registrar, is operating in good faith versus deception entries in the registration data. I've been receiving, lots of those recently where somebody's just typing in, who is privacy protected as their registrant information, and that's not very helpful, because unless the registrars are actually doing some sort of better verification, all that does is help help spammers evade a filter, or a marker that we use to identify spam, and it's probably even better than putting down Mickey Mouse, as the registrar. So I think we have a lot of work ahead of us in that whole area.
Thank you, Dave. These are all very good and important discussions. I'd like to come back to the outline that Julie had. Jeremy, so in the Brussels presentation, there's an issue, there's mm-hmm. a comment on the variant. So I did have a few email exchanges on this issue, and the issue is the IDN names, the IDN domain names, they're usually variants, particularly in the Indian language and the Chinese language, and sometimes what Greg Aaron from Aphelios told me is that there are so many variants in the Indian language, this could be in the hundreds. I don't know whether that's that the Chinese language will have as much variant as possible, but I'd like to see how does the Chinese manage its variant. Is Jianka on the line?
Yes.
Jianka, could you help us with this?
For Scenic, we manage the Chinese variants according to IETF RFC 3743. So for example, in Tsinghua University, there are four Chinese characters, Tsinghua Dachu. So maybe there have more than 16 variants for the same IDN domain. Currently, we have register the explanation of simplified Chinese and the traditional Chinese characters, but Scenic will give them free all simplified Chinese characters and Tsinghua Dachu and all traditional Chinese characters Tsinghua Dachu. So in the DS Zoom, there will have total at most three domain names, but other variants will not be put in the DS Zoom, but will be protected for the registrants. Other one cannot register the variants. So currently our practice is at most three variants will be put in the DNS soon. Other will be protected. So only the three variants, the variants which are put in the DNS soon will display in Whois. Other will not be displayed. Thank you.
Thank you. That's very helpful. So what I'm hearing is, although there could be, you know, the various, you know, over tens and maybe 20s of variants for given IDN in Chinese, the Scenic would put at most three variants in the DNS zone and reserve the rest for registration. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
So the other question is, what if I query a user, for example, I query a variant that is not in the DNS zone? What would the Whois, what's the behavior for Whois?
For Whois.
So if they query, go ahead.
For Whois, there's only all simplified the Chinese and all traditional Chinese will be put in the DNS zone. Other, so the reserved one will not be in Whois. Only the one in the zone will be displayed in the Whois.
And can be queried. So only the ones in the zone displayed in the zone can be displayed and queried in Whois, right?
Yeah.
Query the reserved ones, so you wouldn't have anything.
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds good. Go ahead. What do others think?
Yeah, this is Dave. I have a question because the variants, I mean, variants, I think have to do with, or that you've talked about so far, have to do with the IDN label, not the registration data. So I think I'd like to understand the relevance or the correlation to registration data. So as an example, if I have a domain that I've registered using a variant in an IDN label, what constraints does that imply on the registration data? Can I use the same variant in the registration data? Can I use other variants in the registration data? I'm sort of concerned that talking about variants pulls us away from focusing on, you know, on things other than domain labels. And
Dave, I think I'm only referring to the variant in the domain label, not any other variants. That's
right.
That's my intent.
Okay, that's good. That's helpful. What does that mean? If there are already standards and conventions for the variants in the IDN guidelines,
right?
Yeah. Then is this an issue that we have to be concerned about with registration data?
So the first part is not quite solved. So when the user query a whois, for example, when the user queried all the simplified Chinese script, do we display the variant, the domain variant in whois? So I think that's kind of a service requirement detail. And second, can user query the variant, one variant, and get, you know, what it represents? So I think that's what I'm trying to get at. Because in the presentation, in the Brussels meeting, we do have this bundled representations of a single AOU label query should be returned. I think that's talking about the variant. Personally, I don't know much enough to say we should go beyond like domain variants, because that would be just a state explosion for whois. So that's my 2 cents.
Yeah, I guess I see that as important. I'm not certain that it's something that doesn't end up falling in the under the responsibility of the registry, or the registrar, because I don't think our group can actually answer that right now. I think what our group can do is try to identify how we're going to represent the data other than the label. And that the more that we spend time looking at A and U label issues, the more we're going to cross into someone else's turf, so to speak.
Yes, I agree.
Sorry about that. This is Jeremy. I'm sorry I dropped off for a bit, and it sounds like we're talking about the variants. One of the things that I couldn't quite get a firm grasp on was, I guess it's a fuzzy match or a fuzzy logic where you would do a query for something with a particular family, scripted family, and then you get back all the variants. I'm trying to figure out what's the use case where that's actually useful, where you would request something in one particular, one specific variant, and then you get all of the other variants back. Is there a use case where that's helpful?
For Chinese, if you query one variant in the zoo, then other variant domain IDN will be returned at same time. All the IDN variants in the zoo will be returned. You query any of the zoo, any of the IDN in the DNS zoo, but other IDN names will not be returned. That is for reservation only. If you return all IDNs, there may be hundreds. It is impossible to display all the IDN names. In other way, not every variant, IBM variant is user frankly, same frequency. For example, in Chinese, only fully simplified Chinese and fully traditional Chinese IDM are frankly used. Some combination is not usually used. Only in some special case, the variant is used. So in my opinion, so we should report score the frequency of IDM variants. Some are frequently used and should be displayed in quiz and should be put in DNS rule. Other there will seldom used IDM names should not be put in DNS rule or not put in quiz. Thank you.
I think that's a reasonable policy for us to assume. As we look further at the registration data.
Okay. Also from Jiankang is the who is so the registrars should return the most frequently used IDM variants in the whois. Is that right? Instead of all the variants.
This is Jeremy. That would seem to make sense. Although in a more generic, I could understand how that works for a ccTLD, because you have a pretty well defined user constituency. You know what the user community is in terms of their language set. But
right.
Global, it'd be difficult to mandate what a global sense or what a global TLD would want to return for different variants. And so I'm not sure that it's certainly helpful in the sense that it's not returning all the variants. It's returning the variants that make the most sense. But in the gTLD space, I'm not sure we have the context to make an assumption of what specific variants there are, and I guess not knowing what variants you should return, maybe you should only do one or kind of the most specific that you can think of.
That's a valid point. It's what you're saying it's not make it mandatory, but make it optional. Is that?
Well, I think this is Dave again. I think there's a subtle difference between .cn understanding and appreciating what the most commonly used variants are for the ccTLD and trying to understand what the most common variants of Chinese are for a gTLD where hundreds of countries employ or have users who register Chinese names. So I think it becomes significantly more idiosyncratic, as you localize this, but it becomes exactly the opposite as you go global.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jiankang Yao. For my opinion, in other words, so the whois should only display the IDM variants that are put in DNS rule, So although IDM variants in the DNS rule will be in one package, should be displayed to the user at the same time. If you display the variants that are not in the DNS zone, so that I
Jiankang?
I see. So if so I think we're almost saying the same thing. Your restriction is based on, you know, on sort of two criteria. It's a variant that you recognize, and it's also a variant that's used in a label that's been instantiated in the zone file.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So we have an agreement on that. I don't see, Jeremy, what's the use case for displaying variant?
This is Jeremy. Was that a question?
Yes. I mean, am I rephrasing your question correctly? Are you? You're essentially questioning whether there's a use case globally for variant, right?
Yeah, that's essentially I'm asking what's the, in a more global context, why would you, I can understand for localized within country applications because you want to render text slightly more readable, but I'm guessing with the various use cases, you're not going to have somebody who is using a variant or a dialect and trying to communicate with that person. It's probably for a more official purpose. So the reasoning for a variant or for displaying multiple variants is probably less likely. But no, I'm not an expert in the area, so I'm just kind of making.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, I think that the general question of why displaying variants is important, especially in the GTLD context, where you're probably not interested in all the other ways it could be. You're interested in the most specific case.
Okay. That's a valid question. I will write it up and post this to the working group. We have about 15 minutes left.
Someone has mail.
Yes. Julie's second point was issues remaining to be addressed. Could we have a quick discussion on that? What are some of the issues for this working group that remains needs to be addressed?
This is Jeremy. So I guess the couple of quick ones that we have, at least that I've been keeping track of, that we need to have some agreement on is which of the approaches, in the sense of ASCII requirements, exist. And I think that that's present in pretty much all of the contact elements. I think that there's a question of what display, whether or not we're just talking about port 43, who is, or web-based, and how those two are impacted.
Would you repeat the second question? I didn't get it. Port 43, who is?
Port 43, who is, and a web-based who is, because I think that the two of them have come up as potentially separate sets of requirements or separate things.
And what was the question? The question is
whether we treat them separately or whether they have different requirements. Or because I think we've always been talking about port 43 as the as the system, but as was brought up, I think a couple weeks before Brussels, they actually look a little bit different in the sense of how they might respond. I think the web-based query tool is a little bit more robust and potentially able to have more language support.
Okay. Any other questions? Issues?
So, Jeremy, can I ask you why you conclude that? Is it an order of complexity or?
No, actually, I think web-based protocols have a lot more, they have a greater understanding of what language and what scripts and how text is rendered back. Because HTML and HTTP have a great framework for handling language translations, and it's not just, we've been kind of talking about port 43, who is trying to key off of what the query string is and trying to look at what characters are in that query string in order to determine language and family. And you don't need to do that in a web context. So I'm saying that the web context is actually a little bit easier to provide alternatives. It makes it easier to do the display.
Well, I'm the only reason I'm asking is because I guess my sort of intuition said that if the font's not present in the operating system, it doesn't matter. So maybe I'm too immersed in how I used to get terminal settings for Telnet, but
it could be. I mean, if you download Firefox or Opera or Safari or Internet Explorer, they typically have a pretty wide range of language support, and the fonts are actually loaded in there. So the display makes it a lot easier, and also in the actual transmission of requesting and displaying documents, there's a lot more language support.
Okay, so actually, what I think what you're saying is that the existence of client applications that have the proper character sets bundled is more prevalent among browsers than it is among client command line.
Yeah, that'd be a fair way of saying it.
Okay.
The other one would be is that your data transport in HTTP is also very well encapsulated, so it's you don't have the same type of problems in, like when we were talking about extending the 43 whois and trying to figure out backwards compatibility. It was a lot more complicated to think about how whether they were going to be some sort of XML encasing or something like that. You don't have those problems have already been solved, I think, in the HTTP world.
Right, and those are the issues that Jim Galvin had raised a couple of times. Where are we going to use some sort of MIME, MIME encapsulation or XML because he had mentioned that. I think it's valuable for us to make both those observations in a report.
Right, this is Avery. Can I add? I think it is good to make those observations, but at some point that then will enter sort of a policy area of if we're not saying it's impossible, then one has to decide whether contractually and everything else, those bits of backward compatibility need to be there or not.
I agree.
And so that's where we're really on a cusp. And so we probably should say it's possible, but it's really hard, or it's not possible. I think it's probably possible, but really hard as opposed to not possible. But I haven't delved deeply enough into them to say that for sure. Thanks.
Right.
Okay. I've taken them down. Any other open issues that needs to be addressed?
This is Bob Hutchison again. At the comment period in Brussels, they also spoke about Iris, and I didn't hear a response from this group, or maybe it's not part of the scope of this group, as to how that work relates to what's going on, I guess, in the second part of the report Dave did.
I'm sorry? How is Iris related to this working group?
Jeremy, I don't think that it's certainly of interest, but I think it's the wrong answer. Iris is a technical implementation of registry and data. Very may well be a great implementation for a set of requirements. I think we want to define what the requirements are, and then think about what technical things might exist out in the world. And so that was, somebody asked that during the working group, and I think that was essentially the answer I gave, which is, Iris might be great for the things that it's designed for and what the standard says that it's designed for, but I think we're still trying to figure out what the business rules and the policies are.
Sorry, if I can add to that. I think something that would be useful to encourage the proponents of IRIS is after this comes out, for them or someone else to basically look at the requirements, look at our IRIS and say, yep, yep, no, but easy, yep, you know, and go through it and do an analysis. But I wouldn't see it as being part of this group, but certainly a great response to the work of this group.
So, Aubrey, this is Dave. If you run into someone who's a proponent for IRIS, would you please point them in my direction? Because they're about as they're about as rare as diamonds. As, you
know. Or a minority.
And it would really be interesting to actually have somebody who's a proponent of IRIS to ask questions of and get perspectives from, because all we hear is naysaying against IRIS. Yeah. Just for completeness' sake, if nothing else, I'd like to understand who still likes this.
Okay, yeah, I'll have to. I mean, I've heard people, you know, during the past couple of years bring it up, but now I have to remember who it was that would say, you know, we should. And so I'll try and remember and get them to volunteer. Have we looked at the talk to, you know, the people that did the original work on it, and see if they're still proponents of their product and want to take a stab at answering anything.
Well, there's currently no working implementation of full IRIS, and the original architects of IRIS has moved on to RESTful Who Is.
I was just about to share the same thing.
Which some people might say is the way forward. This is Jeremy. That it's RESTful Who Is. That's the new thing that we should be chasing after.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is Aubrey again. So if we can't find such proponents, it may fall on either this group or someone from, you know, the naysayers group to do a proper analysis so that it can be permanently put to bed. To say, I haven't studied IRIS. I don't know the answer to it. But if there are several proposals, someone's going to have to take IRIS and put it to bed, because I know while I was, you know, playing chair of GNSO, people would constantly bring it up as, well, we should. And, you know, if only I could remember who was saying that we should. But it was constantly there as a refrain.
Good.
I think that probably falls on Steve and I to, you know, to consider as we wrap up the service requirements work for the GNSO, my suspicion is that what the underlying the requirements that we would have for IRD are probably a subset of the requirements that we would overall have for Who Is.
So as time is running short,
one other point. Was mentioned in the variants discussion that in India you may have hundreds of variants. I don't know if we have anybody from that community on the call or who understands the root of that. I would like to understand what hundreds of variants in one language or one script means, because I guess I don't believe that's the case. And maybe somebody could elucidate that.
Ram Mohan, I think, has a great knowledge of Indian variants. And Aphelios, who is also operating the Indian top GTLD, if they run into this issue. But when Ram was next on the call, and we'll make sure to ask him about that.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah,
and this is Dave. I know that in other conversations, Ram and Greg Avin have mentioned that India has, I believe, at least 20, maybe the accurate number is like 22 or 23 or 26 official variants in the Hindi language. Yeah. So, whether it's 100 or whether it's 20, it's an awful lot more than two.
What are the next steps in preparing recommendations and implementations plan? What does the working group think on this question?
should we use everybody?
Well, maybe I can. Maybe as staff, I can ask Jeremy, as the chair, what would you like to see staff do next?
I'm not sure, but I have one thought. Don't we, obviously, it seems to me we're at the point of figuring out what the end game is for this group to get to a final report and put it out and say we're done. So I'm not quite sure what that set of steps is, but that, I think, outlining those and how we get closure on the group might be something that was helpful. As I say, this is Aubrey speaking totally out of turn.
So, again, this is Dave. Would having Steve and I put together a list that says a list of the issues that we've discussed so far, and what we believe the working party has concluded with respect to each of those issues, be the first step? So that, you know, once again, we actually we will be able to put in front of the working party sort of a status report. Here's where we believe we are with the issues that were originally handed to us to study. We believe we have closure or some sort of working agreement on these. These are the those that are still outstanding are here. And in the meantime, we could start to prepare a report describing each of the issues and what the working party recommends.
This is Bob Hutchinson again. I would take the slide deck from the presentation and roll that backwards into a Word document and use that form as a way to put together the recommendations for each. For each one of the issues and to track for the group, and I would basically start with that in terms of a form for how we're going to communicate our findings.
It's a good suggestion. Could certainly do that. Any other thoughts? Any thoughts on how we can bring closure to some of these topics? I think preparing the report should be less complicated than reaching consensus or bring closure.
Yeah, I think there's in the slide deck itself. There's a number of issues that are still listed as open, and perhaps somebody could pull those out for the next conference call and send them out as agenda items for people to be discussing or thinking about.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. So pull the open issues out and send out as agenda items for people to discuss. Okay. Any other thoughts? Rafik, Jin Kang, do you have some thoughts on
No.
Okay. I think these are very helpful discussions.
Good call.
Yeah. For the meeting schedule, since Julie is not here, I would opt not to change the current status quo for now. We continue to rotate meeting times for geographical preferences. Is that okay with people on the call for now? Okay.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining today's IRD call. I think it's a very productive call. The staff will prepare a meeting notes and send it to the working group. And also on that meeting notes, we'll have some action items now. And we also just identify the open issues that discussed today. So with that, I would like to close today's call. Thank you so much for participation.
Thank you, Steve.
Bye.
Bye, all.
Bye. Bye.